This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. I'm going to start in media critic mode. Last night's Republican presidential debate on CNN showed that network at its very worst, blending pandering with a myopic focus on candidates' attacks on one another. The bombastic tone of the opening sequence was followed by questions that were meant solely to get responses just like this one.
Jeb doesn't really believe I'm unhinged. He said that very simply because he has failed in this campaign. It's been a total disaster. Nobody cares. And frankly, I'm the most solid person up here. I built a tremendous company, and all I want to do is make America great again.
In case you didn't know, that was Donald Trump. Today on The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable, we're going to be talking about the news of the week, starting with last night's Republican presidential debate in Las Vegas. Later on, we're going to be talking about Governor Malloy and guns. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, wnpr.org/where we live. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Joining us, as always, is the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR, Colin McEnroe. Hi there, Colin. Well, Colin, wake up. Wake up. Did you stay up late last night watching the debate by any chance?
A little bit.
A little bit. Thanks so much for coming in. Leah Wright Rigueur is here. She's assistant professor of public policy at the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. Her most recent book is The Loneliness of the Black Republican, Pragmatic Politics and the Pursuit of Power. Good to have you in studio, Leah.
Thanks for having me back.
And Kevin Rennie is here. He's an attorney and he's a columnist for the Hartford Current. Hello once again, Kevin.
Good morning, John. Well, I stayed up late too, but I'm perkier than you are.
I know. I got a little bit of sleep last night. I have to say that staying up last night is one of the things that you have to do when you're going to do a program like this on Wednesday morning. I just want to go around, first of all, and just to get a couple of top-line thoughts from each of you about this debate last night. Colin, you know, I saw CNN as a little bit of the problem last night. We can talk through that a little bit more. What did you see in last night's debate?
Well, yeah, no, I'd have to go along with that. I think the way they framed things was borderline offensive. In other words, watching this debate, if you didn't know anything about recent history, you would imagine that really San Bernardino was the only thing that had happened in America that was alarming over the, say, 15 years since 9/11. And that's obviously not the case. We've had, you know, a good count on domestic terrorism is probably about 93 people who've died from it. About half of them have been the objects of Muslim terrorism, the rest other kinds of terrorism. You know, and I'm not suggesting the 14 people dead in San Bernardino isn't a high death toll and something to be very worried about, but the kind of state of emergency attitude that was projected last night, as though we really were already on a war footing. I think that was Ben Carson's. It's kind of like, would these people know a war footing if they really saw one? Because this isn't it right now. This is peacetime. We have some problems here. We have some threats domestically, but they don't exist at the level that they were being talked about right now last night. There are bigger problems. There are more Americans dying from other preventable things. But I blame CNN a little bit for letting them. You would not have thought, for example, that the Colorado shooting ever happened if you were watching last night. I blame CNN for sort of keeping that frame up and not forcing them to look at bigger pictures.
Well, and bigger pictures, which include a whole conversation we're going to have later about how gun policy in America plays into all of this. The fact is that the San Bernardino shooting does have that overlay as well, and it was for many of us here, we were thinking about this on the week of the anniversary of the Sandy Hook shootings, Colin. So, yes, there are probably some other things that we could have at least mentioned, but I'll put that at the feet of CNN, too.
Yeah. And I mean, other than that, I mean, I do think, I guess maybe my other aperçu from last night is I'm pretty good friends with a Jeb Bush supporter, and I sent him an email saying, you know, really, Richard Nixon was the last American president who had an undisguisable mean streak. You know, you could talk about a lot of other people who've been president since then who had character flaws of various kinds that they were either good or not so good at hiding. And most of them have some problems with the whole area of truth. But it's hard to get elected if you're mean. At least that's what I thought. And really watching last night, I mean, there were these moments where, first of all, it sounded – they were all sort of barking like some out-of-control kennel. And the frequency with which people – it wasn't just Trump either. I mean, several of them demonstrated, you know, undisguised mean streaks. And I'm wondering, could you now get elected? Has civility broken down to the point where you could be a different kind of person and get elected president? I don't know the answer to that question, but I find myself asking it last night.
It is true that the meaner that Donald Trump gets, the better he does in the polls. That may be one of the things that many of the candidates are looking at. What did you see last night, Leah?
So, you know, Donald Trump is a good starting point because it's really the reality TV presidential race. Everything was Donald Trump. It was the Donald Trump show. I had moments where it felt like he was the only person on stage. And the inability of certain candidates, I think, to push him or even the moderators to push him and push back against him is really disturbing to me. So it was like a really bad reality TV show. But at the same time, it's the reality TV show that we're all watching.
Well, in many ways, CNN framed so many of the opening questions around Trump's statements in the past about allowing Muslims into the United States. But after a fashion, many of the candidates did take off after one another. There was a number of back and forths between the senators on stage. Those were then countered by Chris Christie, who I think echoed what an awful lot of Americans were thinking at the time, which is, if I hear one more thing about one tiny vote that someone took 5 years ago, I'm going to scream. And I think that that was a big piece of what happened after the opening sequence. It wasn't just all about Donald Trump, was it, Leah?
You know, it actually was about Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio, right? And those big tiffs that they got into. Tiff is actually not the word. They were arguing on stage. It got heated. And I think that is actually one of the things to watch, right? How Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio lock up, how they intersect, how they argue with one another, and where they differ on very specific and important topics.
Kevin, how about you? What did you see last night?
I saw a national political party that has, with any, as any national political party does, has a lot of strains of thought. And the Republicans, because there's not, the race is open, the Republicans have candidates who represent a lot of those strains. The Democrats don't, because they're mostly afraid to challenge Hillary Clinton. So you're not seeing that on the Democratic side. On the Republican side, you have all these candidates. I think the debates are too long. It's just yes. They're too long.
We're just getting started.
We're just getting started. Frightening. They're too long. They need to. I would work the debate a different way. I would give each candidate an equal amount of time. They can use it as they please, and just keep asking questions till the time's up. But I do think that you have to remember. I'm going to guess you're probably more likely to be a Democrat than a Republican, John. For Republicans, look at any poll. National security is by far the number one issue. And these debates tend to focus on a narrow range of issues, each one. Some will be domestic. Some will be foreign policy. But right now, foreign policy and security and terror, it's the big issue among Republicans. And the candidates themselves are emphasizing what probably for a lot of people are not huge differences, but they're magnifying them.
Well, and I think we did see, and I'll just for the record, a very proud independent voter, mm-hmm. never aligned with a political party. I will say, however, that last night I did start to see more than in previous debates the differences between the three senators on stage coming out. As I noted, Chris Christie trying to get into the debate and talking about what it takes to be a leader of a state.
John, did you know that he was a former federal prosecutor?
Yeah, wondering if you were going to mention that. Well, actually, here's the thing that Chris Christie said last night that took me a little bit by surprise.
I would make very clear, I would not talk to Vladimir Putin. In fact, I would talk to Vladimir Putin a lot. And I'd say to him, listen, Mr. President, there's no fly zone in Syria. You fly in, it applies to you. And yes, we would shoot down the planes of Russian pilots if, in fact, they were stupid enough to think that this president was the same feckless weakling that the president we have in the Oval Office is right now.
So I wanted to play that, Kevin, because, we hear an awful lot of things in these debates, and sometimes these barbs, well, they get more barbed, as Leah says, all the time. I don't know that I'd actually heard a candidate talk about the sitting president of the United States as a feckless weakling ever before. Have I
think
heard?
He has. I think feckless is a has been in circulation.
It's like the word of 2015.
Weakling is also. I don't know if we've heard them together, but yeah, there has been. And I heard Lindsey Graham, who I guess did very well on the first debate earlier in the evening, saying that this sort of visceral dislike of a president, any president, is not good for our our body politic. It wasn't good when it was aimed at George W. Bush. It's not good when it's aimed at Barack Obama. And Chris Christie always, you know, what I've noticed in the last few debates is Carly Fiorina really gets under his skin. I don't understand that. She's done it before, and that was in direct response. His answer was in response to her saying she wouldn't talk to Putin until she was in more of a position of strength herself. And she's gotten under his skin before. The thing about Chris Christie last night was when he said, you know, I'm an executive, and when I make decisions, if the people of New Jersey will tell me if they don't like them. And I thought, yes, you have one of the lowest approval rates in the nation. And I thought if any other candidate on that stage thought he was a threat, they would have pointed that out. And I just don't think they believe he's a threat yet.
Well, you know, I mean, the other part of that statement, which I think Rand Paul called him on, was that notion of shooting down Russian planes. And I think Paul said, okay, you want to see what World War III looks like? Here's your guy.
Yeah.
I mean, in fact, the Russians are there to a certain degree in collaboration with us post-Paris. They're there, I think, as Paul pointed out, at the invitation of other nations. I mean, it's simply not the case that you could shoot down Russian planes and just have that be
– And why would you? We disagree with what the Russians. The Russians essentially are there for Assad, and they're bombing the rebels. They did not start out bombing ISIS until after that plane exploded in Egypt. But that's no reason to go to war with Russia.
And I thought that was – I mean, there were a number of things that were said last night that I thought were sort of reflected either an intentional or unintentional lack of sophistication about even how war is waged in that part of the world. I mean, Ted Cruz – and he kind of got away with it too. You know, he was asked to say more about his call for carpet bombing, and he tried to thread a needle where there's no hole in the needle. He was essentially saying, I'm in favor of carpet bombing where ISIS is but kind of not where anybody else is. And there is no such – I mean, first of all, the nature of carpet bombing is that it's an unsophisticated military tool. It doesn't really pick and choose very much.
Right.
If you're going to be in favor of carpet bombing, you're basically committing to a campaign where you're going to kill a lot of civilians while you're – I mean, overspreading a large area with explosives. And the fact that he's unhappy with the amount of tonnage dropped already. I mean, I think there's – if you add the 6,800 American strikes in the last 465 days to the ones done by our coalition partners, it's around 8,000 strikes. That's nothing to him. He wants like a lot more. But somehow or other, he was allowed to say – but there wouldn't be much collateral damage somehow.
Well, because it's targeted carpet bombing. I will just quickly say that was one of the strengths of the CNN moderators. When they finally got around to asking a question, if they didn't have the question answered, they would ask it again. And that was one which he was pushed back on. That was part of the conversation. Where are we going to carpet bomb ISIS and how many people are we going to take out? Later, Leah, Donald Trump's talking about killing the wives and the children of the ISIS terrorists. There was an awful lot of talk about who we're going to kill and how, you know, much we'll kill them. And that set a tone that was a little disturbing throughout the course of the evening.
Right. So it kind of set up a bar that said in order to be president, you have to be willing to kill civilians, kill babies. I mean, the questions were asked over and over again. And, you know, I'm not a Rand Paul fan, and I disagree with him on a lot of things. But he consistently came out during the debate to say, what are we talking about? Are we talking about waging war? Are we talking about violating the Geneva Conventions? Are we talking about things that are unconstitutional? This is not what we should be talking about, and trying to shift the conversation. And that's very much in tune with who he is as a politician, as a senator, and things like that. But it's striking to see in a particular moment when Rand Paul seems to be the candidate on stage who's making the most sense.
I think – could I just double down on that point for a second? I think that's a really important point, that Paul, who – both Paul and his father are often depicted as isolationists. I think his father was more – I mean, I think his father was in favor of withdrawing us from like the International House of Pancakes. But but these are guys who basically sort of are non-adventurists and therefore – presumably less interested in foreign theaters. But Paul was more sophisticated about this, more an obvious citizen of the world, more familiar, as you say, with things like the Geneva Convention. So the guy who supposedly isn't really interested in foreign adventures did seem to understand foreign politics better than anybody else.
Kevin?
I thought that the question that prompted that answer, it did come through Facebook, and I always sort of cringe when I think, oh, boy, what's this going to be? That student from Georgia Tech asked the best question
of the night. Best question of the night.
Best question of the night.
Yep.
And I also, I think it is important to point out that there were other candidates who agreed with her and said why they agreed with her and pointed out not only humanitarian reasons but strategic reasons why she was absolutely right. And I thought to myself, well, we have 11 months of every now and then a good question from Facebook. That's the campaign will not be as painful as I'm expecting. But that it was very unusual to get a question like that that just bores right in.
Well, I have to ask before we
excuse me, yeah, by the way,
yeah.
Donald Trump, as usual, could not answer that question in a way that a seventh grade teacher would give him at least a B on his answer.
Kevin, I'd also like to ask you, my sense of Hugh Hewitt last night, Hugh Hewitt was sort of the outside CNN addition to the questioning panel. I actually, there were twice that I thought that Trump was right about things. And one of them was when he basically said that he'd been kind of targeted. And I actually thought Hugh Hewitt had an agenda to damage Trump, to get him out of the race, to do anything he could to expose him. And the nuclear triad question, which Trump either didn't understand or didn't have the tools to answer or both, struck me as a little bit of a gotcha question.
I disagree.
You disagree?
It pains me to disagree with you, Colin, but I have to tell you. No, you know what? I thought first of all, that's Hugh Hewitt's MO. He does ask those sorts of detailed policy questions that, you know, they're not big. You don't hear them often in a campaign. But in terms of being president of the United States, they do kind of matter.
Oh, yeah. It's not unreasonable to want.
And so he is the front runner, as Donald Trump was happy to say various times, by quite a lot. And I thought, you know, that's a good question to ask. It'd be interesting to know, test the depth of their knowledge. And I thought his answer was frightening. Was frightening. He had no idea.
And Hewitt gave him two shots at it.
Yes.
Too. Yeah.
Yes. And I thought, you know, the funny thing is, and these candidates, they don't really – I don't think they view it as a debate. They view it as an opportunity to use their maybe 6.5 to 7 minutes to make an impression. And I thought that Marco Rubio was pretty subtle in the follow-up to say, well, this is what the nuclear triad is. And he left out – and that idiot over there.
I think he said, in case people at home are wondering.
Which is actually a pretty good line. Yeah. You always use that when you can. We're talking today with Kevin Rennie, who's a columnist for the Hartford Courant, Colin McEnroe from the Colin McEnroe Show, Leah Wright-Rigger from the Kennedy School at Harvard University. When we come back, we'll talk more about what happened at last night's GOP debate, talk a bit more about national security and about all the military spending that candidates want to see happen. We're also going to be talking about Dana Malloy and gun policy. That's coming up next, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. It's Wednesday, so it's the Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. Conveniently, there was a Republican debate last night, so we have something to talk about this morning. We're talking about it with Kevin Rennie, columnist for the Hartford Courant, Leah Wright-Rigger, who is assistant professor of public policy at the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard, and our own Colin McEnroe, who hosts the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. What's on your show today, Colin?
We are doing a show. This is not in any way paired up with last night's debate. Our show is about the problem of evil, theologically and otherwise.
Oh, very good. So you're taking on the topic of evil this
afternoon.
Happy
holidays.
Happy holidays from the Colin McEnroe Show. That's just lovely. Before we took our break, I just wanted to ask Kevin Rennie about this. You said, Kevin, that national security is top of the list for Republican voters. I want to get through some of what we heard about national security because we heard a lot of different flavors of it. Do you have a sense of what Republican voters may be wanting to hear when we actually talk about national security? Because we're talking about domestic terrorism, terrorism at home, how we're going to shut down the borders, keep people from coming in, how we're going to fight ISIS and other threats overseas. What are the national security topics you heard talked about? What are the things you think that people actually need to hear a little bit more about from the candidates?
Well, I think they probably need to have longer answers, the opportunity for longer answers. And those answers would start with how we got where we are today and how we're going to change that. Those are, you know, those are complicated answers. But I think Republican, especially Republican caucus goers and then Republican primary voters are receptive to that. But this isn't the kind of forum that gives you an opportunity to do that. I mean, Carly Fiorina tries, and you know she's very big on her sort of PowerPoint answers of, you're going to give me a chance to tell you my solution, my plan to stop terrorism. But you know, these debates, they don't encourage those kinds of discussions. You have short answers. everyone's looking for a moment. I mean, you could tell with John Kasich with his my daughter's friend said, you argue too much or something. You know, and he's looking. They're looking for a moment where they'll be the clip. And that's, you know, sophisticated policy discussions or even extended policy discussions that aren't that sophisticated don't lend themselves to that.
But when you talk about the whole question of how we got here, actually Donald Trump in his way got at that in a way that, you know, nobody else really did. He complained about our adventurism overseas in the Iraq war and the billions of dollars spent. And he said something that was that Carly Fiorina later challenged that sounded very unlike something you would hear on a Republican debate stage, which is, I wish I had that $4 billion back because I'd spend it at home. I'd rebuild bridges and roads and that sort of thing.
He said $4 trillion.
$4 trillion. I'm sorry. Yeah. Yes, I apologize. $4 trillion. Yes.
And as I heard that, I thought, you know, if anyone needs any proof that he is not a Republican, it's that comment. Because how about, wouldn't it be nice if people had that $4 trillion to spend as or not spend as they wish? But he is a big spending New York Democrat. That's what he is. He loves government.
Did that comment by Trump strike you the same way? Because it did me, and I thought it went relatively unchallenged by anybody else on stage, because one of the things I want to talk about next is this notion of how much money we are going to or need to spend on the U.S. military, whereas when we have a debate about the economy, each of the candidates talks about how they're going to cut the size of government. So here we've got Donald Trump on one hand sounding an awful lot like a New York liberal in the way he's going to spend money to rebuild our infrastructure, and other folks not really challenging him on this.
Yeah, he sounded like Franklin Roosevelt, the New Deal, right? Rebuilding our cities, rebuilding our bridges, infrastructure, things like that. But, you know, I think
the classiest New Deal ever, yes. By the way. But anyway, please continue.
It's huge. It'll be the best and they'll build it. But the interesting thing to me is to think about who Donald Trump is speaking to and who are the people who are flocking to Donald Trump. And he is tapping into something that has strains amongst, I think, working class blue collar people, right, who are also, in addition to being concerned about national security and borders, are also concerned about jobs and the economy. And those are the kinds of things, I think, where we get interesting kind of overlap, where people move beyond kind of traditional ideology. And we're starting to see, I mean, white working class men love Donald Trump. And he is speaking to them and he is saying the kinds of things that they want to hear. And I think that is part of what they want to hear. And having it come from somebody, you know, whether it be Donald Trump or whomever, it's easy to say, you know, to ignore that label, to ignore where it's coming from because they like what they're hearing.
Colin?
I think I heard a little something more than that, and maybe I've got it wrong, but obviously, yeah. So he said what he said, and Carly Fiorina jumped in and said, that's exactly what Barack Obama says. But then what ensued was a slightly more subtle conversation among them about the whole question of regime change and whether or not it makes sense to take out tyrants or manage tyrants. So Saddam Hussein is case in point. You know, really, we degraded his capacity prior to the 2003 invasion. And so he's essentially the mayor of Baghdad as opposed to the ruler of Iraq. It's not a bad way to deal with somebody like that. And one of the things that's harder to do, given the current situation in Syria, is argue for destabilization, right? We can see very easily what happens in a destabilized Middle East situation. Every time you pull out a tyrant, you know, the blocks kind of fall and scatter in very unpredictable ways. So, you know, they actually did start to have a conversation. Do you get rid of Assad? Do you manage Assad? What do you do with people in these situations? I did agree with what Trump said on both counts. I do think, you know, a lot of this stuff has resulted in chaos and expense and stuff like that. But I was surprised. I wondered if it might betoken a beginning of a different kind of Republican conversation about foreign policy, that you don't necessarily go out and take out somebody you don't like simply to do that without some kind of understanding of what happens when that guy goes.
Colin, I don't know, Kevin. Colin may be reading more nuance into that conversation than maybe I heard. How about you?
Cruz in particular, I thought, was saying that.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah,
yes. And, you know, it is. Yeah. And on the other hand, there's the notion of, you know, these are dictators who, you know, let me go back. There are also the idea, and which I think is true, is that in Libya, that was an organic movement within Libya.
And in
same
Egypt.
Thing in Egypt and,
right.
and same thing in Syria. That's so right. that we're not the puppet masters, that these things happen, and they happen to such an extent that then we're forced we're forced
it's
to
out of
react.
Our control. Yes.
We're forced to react.
That's right.
And because we do, you know, we do have an aversion to chaos, and we know what it can bring. And the issue is, what do we do about that gathering chaos? Mm. And that's where they disagree.
Yeah, and as Jeb Bush said last night, Donald Trump is the chaos candidate. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Derek's calling from Windsor. Hey, Derek, what's on your mind?
Oh, hey, John. Great job as usual.
Thank you.
I want to ask the question, why are we so easily swayed as a people? And let me just say, security is important. It might be at the top of the list. But if I remember clearly, when this election cycle started, the economy was right up there, one or two, I think. Now it has fallen down to about five or six. And I'm wondering how much of this is fear-mongering, mostly by the Republicans, because they seem to play into this quite well. You could see on the stage last night, everybody, you look on the face, you could see they're excited to talk about security, which is fine. But if we continue down this road, every time we shift from the economy into security, and like I said, security is important, when is the economy going to come back and fix the way it's supposed to be? Because the economy isn't still in bad shape, even though the job rate is about 5% or so. It's still in bad shape.
Well, hey, Derek, thank you for the question. I'm just going to take that to Leah, because obviously there's a lot of things that have happened since the last Republican debate, and most of them have to do with our fears as a nation, and they have to do with national security and domestic security much more than the economy. Derek's question, though, is a very important one. And to go back to criticizing CNN, there probably is a way to have framed the questions last night about security, domestic and international, in a way that actually ties in people's real fears about the economy as well. And it's just not something that we heard.
Right. So this is my frustration with the debate, is which is that, granted, it was on foreign policy, but we heard very, very little from the candidates about what were their plans for economic resurgence, for keeping people in jobs, for helping people, except for really Donald Trump. And I think part of this is that the politics of fear sells. It sells candidates. We know that negative campaign advertising works well. It sticks in people's mind. But then coupled that with the kind of idea of we'll make America great again, that's something that people really latch on to. And we can see it with Donald Trump. He is surging in the polls. You know, it'll be interesting to have a conversation maybe a little bit later on about how this debate is going to help or hurt these people. And really not talking about the economy hasn't hurt these people thus far.
You know, but before we get to that, because I want to actually end this segment on that, but I want to get to one other thing we really haven't talked about. A lot of divides did come out last night. One of them had to do with a gathering of intelligence. The libertarian wing of the party is opposed to government surveillance. Ted Cruz, Rand Paul got into this with Marco Rubio. Let's listen to a little bit of Marco Rubio here.
This is not just the most capable, it is the most sophisticated terror threat we have ever faced. We are now at a time when we need more tools, not less tools. And that tool we lost, the metadata program, was a valuable tool that we no longer have at our disposal.
And so now here's Ted Cruz explaining why he voted against the National Defense Authorization Act.
When I campaigned in Texas, I told voters in Texas that I would oppose the federal government having the authority to detain U.S. citizens permanently with no due process. I have repeatedly supported an effort to take that out of that bill, and I honored that campaign commitment.
In the hours and hours of coverage that we had last night, Kevin, I was, again, heartened that at least we spent a little bit of time digging in on some of the differences around intelligence gathering and how that might help or hurt a war against ISIS.
Yes, because that's one more part of terrorism issue. That was a terrible answer by Ted Cruz, by the way. That was just
it was one
terrible,
of a few pretty terrible answers.
I know that he was supposed to be a brilliant debater at Harvard, but that was a terrible, terrible answer. And but it goes to the point that national security is a wide ranging issue, but it's important to remember we're not far away from a really shocking terrorist attack in San Bernardino that appears, you know, that involved someone who had a variety of background checks that failed. And one of the things I think that what would reassure the American people, if we understood how immigrants, refugees are allowed in, who's allowed in, who isn't allowed in, and how does that process work? And I think most of us don't have a clue as to how that works. And I think when the president spoke to the nation just over a week ago, I think he should have spent some time, frankly, lecturing us on it, just explaining how this works. Because I don't know if any of the three of you know the details of how it works. I'd be interested in hearing it.
Well, that's the thing is, I think as we talked about after his speech, you know, just a 13-minute speech in which he didn't tell us very much of anything at all. We were maybe all listening for a little bit more. What did you take about that part of last night's debate, Colin, where we talked about intelligence gathering? We talked about, you know, Carly Fiorina, you know, whether or not she cooperated as the head of HP with the NSA, Donald Trump wanting to, as he says, penetrate the internet, and I'm not quite sure what that means. I mean, obviously, it was good that we had a little discussion and we brought out some clearer lines of demarcation between various camps in the Republican Party.
Yeah, and I now sort of wonder what's the tail and what's the dog. I mean, there's the candidates and there's the American public. I think the American public is very ambivalent about how it feels about all this. I think there's times in which it really regards the NSA as having engaged in overreach in terms of gathering domestic intelligence. In general, I think Americans don't want to live in a country where there's 270 million people or however many there are, and everybody's either on a naughty or nice list, and the government knows something about everybody or has decided it doesn't need to know something about this particular person. I mean, we don't want the elf on the shelf watching us all the time. On the other hand, as Kevin correctly points out, in the aftermath of something like San Bernardino, people flip on this for a while, right? They say, oh, you know, actually, maybe we would like you to know a lot more about everybody if that means I'm not going to get shot.
Well, and if nothing else, maybe we just like to know a little bit more about the systems that are in place to keep us safe. And that's the thing that he was saying before is we don't really know what's there in place now. We don't know what people are looking at. We don't know what the screening systems are. We don't know, and we probably should know a little bit.
Although Rubio, I think, also makes the point, you know, how much of our intelligence infrastructure do you want to lay bare in this chaotic debate structure in front of 15 million viewers? I mean, some of this stuff doesn't need to get talked out probably in some other kind of environment.
No. And I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is how does the process work? I mean, they don't have to show us all the details, but just the process of, and I think we'll get to this when we talk about guns, is how do you get on the no-fly list? How do you get off the no-fly list? It's just these things are pretty mysterious to us, but we're expected to believe that they're well shaped and well administered, and that they're there to protect us.
John Lewis is on the no-fly list.
Yeah, that's right.
And has had problems with this for years. And when you look at the no-fly list, it's kind of a mix of people that we suspect as being, you know, of being terrorists or having terrorist affiliations, radical leftists, civil rights activists, and kind of, you know, people, children have been appointed to the no-fly list. So I think, you know, I think this point about in moments of crisis, immediate crisis, people are on high alert and they are confused and there is a lot of chaos. You know, people who have no connection to the San Bernardino shooting still feel a measure of fear, right? We see this in the aftermath of 9/11 when people in the South are really concerned about acts of terror, even though they are in no way, shape, or form connected to, say, New York City. The one thing that I would say, though, is that for a large subsection of the American population, they are concerned with terrorism, but they are also concerned with domestic acts of terrorism at home, right? Mm-hmm. So things like the Colorado shooting, which didn't come up at all. And I think there was an opportunity, although I don't think we'll see Republican candidates do this, I think there was an opportunity to kind of connect things that happen at home with things that happen abroad and how we need to have come down or have hard stances not only on international terrorism or kind of this abstract idea of terrorism, but also people within our midst, people who are going into churches, people who are going into, say, abortion providers and shooting places up in the name of, say, something like Christianity. So those are issues that should be discussed. I would have loved to have seen the moderators, say, bring that up, but we didn't see it.
Well, Leah, can I just say one thing?
Yeah.
I've been on planes with children who should be on the no-fly list.
Probably my children.
but before we take a break, I mean, there was one little moment in which CNN tried to lob a little bit of a softball to Jeb Bush about this notion of what the party is supposed to look like. And there has long been this question after Barack Obama wins the White House twice, whether or not the Republican Party needs to be more inclusive. And then Donald Trump comes up with some of the rhetoric that he certainly has, and many others have followed it. I know that you've written and you've talked extensively about this, Leah. I mean, what do you expect to hear in the next couple months from a Republican Party that seems to be getting strength behind Donald Trump, saying things like, I want to build a wall, I know how to build, I want to keep immigrants out, when there still is clearly, I think, a need within the party, as expressed by many leaders within the party, that they need to open it up to a lot more people and look and sound an awful lot different on some of these issues?
So I think we'll see a lot of token efforts. So we'll see things like Donald Trump meeting with 100 pastors, 100 preachers. He claims that next month he's going to be meeting with 200 pastors. We'll see Ted Cruz using African-Americans, Latino-Americans to propose certain policies. You know, he also met with a pretty radical, right-wing radical black preacher. Rand Paul has been doing this for 2 years and has been doing pretty heavy work in minority communities. So we will see these kind of token outreach efforts, but a lot of that is undercut by the very, very extreme rhetoric and behaviors of some of the candidates. So a perfect example is the night before last night's debate, at a Donald Trump rally, there's a black protester who comes in and people start screaming obscenities at him. Some people yelled, racial slurs. And one person said, let's light this, curse word on fire. And so I think that's the kind of thing
and
that
Trump
people
later
see.
Said, and maybe he should get roughed up a little bit. I mean, Trump actually endorsed the behavior, which is even freakier.
Right. And so I think part of this is that people don't necessarily say, well, look at this individual act. Look at this individual act. They look at policies, but they also look at the behavior of the worst elements of the party. And so when you look at that, there's absolutely no way. They're doing significant damage. And I think Lindsey Graham brought this up and Rand Paul has brought this up before.
Kevin, a quick thought on this?
Well, if you look at snapshot of the three of the top four contenders right now in the polls, and that's changing a lot. But in the Republican Party, one is a black neurosurgeon and two are Latino, fairly young United States senators. That who would have predicted that?
And you should mention that Ben Carson, every time he's in a bookstore, he buys Leah's book. He goes, Leah's the Black Republican. That sounds kind of like me. I think I'll buy that book.
Well, I'll let you have the last word on this segment, Colin. I mean, how does everything shake out after all this? I mean, does anything substantively change in terms of the stacking of these people? If we all saw them on stage again, would they be standing in different positions?
Well, the conventional wisdom is that Cruz does better in Iowa, that somehow or other the air starts to go out of Trump, right, that post-Iowa. I don't know whether that's true, because everything that everybody says about Trump turns out not to be true. And then the other wisdom is that it kind of turns into a Cruz-Rubio race. I think Leah has kind of alluded to that. And I do think in all the ways that we've just been talking about, Rubio is the person who can maybe speak a little bit more effectively to some of the groups that Leah is talking about, the Republicans seeking to reach but not being very persuasive with. I wouldn't be surprised if one guy who bumps up a little bit is Christie, actually. I think he's still going to be low numbers, except for in New Hampshire, but I bet you his numbers go up a little bit as a result of last night.
Any other thoughts on that?
So I exactly agree. I think that right now that Donald Trump has such a sizable lead in so many polls and in so many areas that, we need to put him in his own category. And really what we're looking at right now is Cruz and Rubio, and who are really duking it out, I think, for second place. And so that's what we have to pay attention to. Carson, who was at one point in second place and at one point even in first place, has, I think, did himself no favors last night. And we're going to see a decline from him steadily going into the Iowa caucuses.
I think that you can't underestimate Ted Cruz. And if he defeats Donald Trump in Iowa, I think that will be a deflating moment for Trump to not come in first there, particularly with all his braggadocio. And then if they go, 10 days later, they're in New Hampshire and Trump doesn't win again. I think that those individual results make a difference as to how they're perceived in the rest of the country.
We're going to be turning next to Governor Daniel Malloy and his latest plan on guns. If you want to join us in the Wheelhouse, 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's program, we're going to listen back to some excerpts from a panel discussion that I moderated at Connecticut College. It was about free speech and race on college campuses. Jelani Cobb, who writes for The New Yorker and is from University of Connecticut, went head-to-head with The Atlantic's Connor Frierdorf. It's something that they've both written about a lot, and it was in front of a very energized audience of about 300 people at Connecticut College. We're going to listen back to some of that on tomorrow's Where We Live. Today, it's the Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. We've been catching up on the news of the week, including last night's Republican debate. We're talking with Colin McEnroe from The Colin McEnroe Show, Kevin Rennie from The Hartford Current, Leah Wright-Rigger, whose latest book is The Loneliness of the Black Republican, Pragmatic Politics and the Pursuit of Power. Last week, Governor Daniel Malloy made national headlines for announcing a ban on gun sales to those on the terrorism watch list or federal no-fly list. Here he's talking about guns during an editorial board meeting with WNPR.
When the NRA has such power over your body politic that you can't deny people a gun that you would deny a seat on a plane, you know you're screwed up.
So that's Governor Malloy talking with us last week, Colin. He later then made this announcement the next day. There's some question over the course of the last week whether or not he had actually been beaten to the punch for something like this by Chris Christie some years ago. But that's not really what we want to talk about. What we want to talk about is this policy, this idea, and whether or not it's actually, well, legal for Governor Malloy to propose what he is proposing here to restrict people who are on a federal no-fly list from getting guns in Connecticut.
Well, first of all, I think this is not completely disconnected from everything we've been talking about so far, because
yes,
Governor Malloy wears two hats these days. The other one is as the head of the Democratic Governors Association. So some of this is picking up on President Obama's speech of two Monday nights ago, where he first brings this up, and it's news to a lot of Americans. And it has kind of a snakes on a plane quality to it. People go, really? You can get – those people can get – they can buy guns? And so – but the reality is, as Leah has already said, first of all, there's some things that are pretty arbitrary about the no-fly list. Ted Kennedy's been on it. John Lewis is on it. It's not due process. It has an extra judicial quality to it. So if you're in favor of due process, you have to be in favor of it across the board. And so at the level of a court challenge – it seems as though it wouldn't be in very good shape. And then there's the whole other question, the question of the mechanism for affecting this policy. It doesn't seem like something you could do by executive order. It seems – I mean, Kevin's the former legislator here, but it seems as though – I mean, I believe in New Jersey that was part of a bill.
It
seems like it probably ought to be part of a bill if it's going to be anything. So the idea that he can just sort of decide to do this, I think it really is a little bit more about scoring points on the national stage than it is about a policy that's going to be in effect in Connecticut.
Scoring points on the national stage, which was one of the reasons why I was just shocked that it wasn't really brought up as a question at all during last night's debate. But that having been said, what's your take on this, Kevin? Again, it does seem like the sort of thing that would be best instituted by, you know, a debate and then a law being passed
sure.
by the state.
Well, I have a few thoughts. One was, well, if you get that list and there's a state employee on it, are you going to say we don't want to finance terrorism so that that employee is going to lose their job with the state of Connecticut? My other thought is that and I've written about this many times. He gave $30 million in public money to Bass Pro Shops to build a gun retail center in Bridgeport. If he really meant what he said about guns, he never would have done that. Never would anyone who cares about guns have done that. And the third thing is, I believe we're in a window right now where anything that keeps people from thinking about what is GE going to do is high on their list. Mm-hmm. I think that within – probably the larger public doesn't feel it, but within government circles, what GE is going to do in their decisions to whether they stay or go is people in government are obsessed about it, and they're reading all sorts of tea leaves that aren't – they're reading leaves that aren't even tea leaves. There are other leaves. And they it's – I think anything to distract from that is moves up the list of issues to shine a light on.
Leah, I mean, is this an issue in which Governor Malloy, taking on this new role as the head of the Democratic Governors Association, is trying to score national points? Is this something that strikes you as appropriate state policy?
So I think it's a feel-good moment for him. I think it's absolutely political. It sounds really good. Again, I mentioned earlier in moments of fear, I think people respond in particular ways. And so it sounds really good right after we have something like the San Bernardino shooting right around the anniversary of Newtown, all of these things to say we are going to crack down on gun control by focusing on people who are on the watch list. In reality, it's a violation of due process, of people's civil liberties. And in fact, the people who are most likely to be affected are people who are not, you know, engaged in all kinds of things. Again, I mentioned John Lewis. I've mentioned children who have been on the watch list, random people, radical leftists, things like that. So I don't think that it's, you know, another way to put this is, if we're going to talk about gun control, we need to be having a different conversation. And unfortunately, those conversations around gun control have not happened because there's so much fear around actually issuing real laws and real policy and real legislation around gun control.
We got a tweet from our friend and panelist often on this program, Kalila Brown-Dean, who says, people hate tying gun access to no-fly lists because it might bar innocent people. Too bad, she writes, the same logic doesn't apply to voter fraud lists. We just have a couple minutes left, Colin. Do you have a quick thought on wrapping up this part of our conversation?
Well, just that, you know, I mean, maybe to double down on something that Leah said, this it's hard to deal with this question by breaking off little pieces of it. That, in fact, gun violence, access to guns is something where you really want to get the whole game board spread out and look at what some of the larger parts of it are and how you're going to deal with it. So, I mean, just to pick one thing, all right, so roughly, I mean, this is a small number out of the it's about 20,000 suicides, about 10,000 violent deaths, you know, flutters around a little bit. I mean, a tiny subset of that, for example, is children who die by accident. Children who die by accidental gunshot, gun that's not properly secured, maybe needed a trigger lock, something like that. That's at least 100 children, small children a year, which is as many people as have died from domestic terrorism since 9/11. So, you know, maybe you could pick that little piece too and take a look at it and say, is that important enough? I mean, if the number of people dying from domestic terrorism is enough for us to have this huge national debate about it, you know, you could probably save little kids without hurting the Second Amendment too much.
But it seems as though we're not – I mean, we didn't have it last night. We're never going to have it during a Republican presidential debate. Kevin, are we ever going to get to that conversation in which we maybe sensibly talk about guns as a public health issue, guns and what the real numbers are, some of these little pieces that Lee and Colin are talking about? Do we get there?
Well, I think the Republican – there'll be a Republican debate where there'll be gun questions. You may not think their answers are – you may not think the questions are sensible. You may not think the answers are sensible. But they will be aiming at voters that
Could
they –
Could you use a different verb, please?
Targeting? Nope, that's not the one.
They may believe – you know, they'll speak to the people they believe choose the Republican nominee for president, just like the Democrats will speak to their direct constituents in the post – in the pre-nomination contest.
We just have a minute left. Daniel Malloy told CT News Junkie in an editorial board meeting with them that he's not ruling out a third term. Any chance that Governor Daniel Malloy runs for a third term, Kevin?
Oh, I hope so. I hope so.
It just gives you so much to write about. Elliot,
you have the way, can we just say, you know, Colin, we started talking about, you know, nasty people.
Yeah.
Obviously, there is an example of a nasty, nasty person being elected governor of Connecticut twice.
Any thoughts, Leah? Does Governor Malloy run a third time?
I think if he does, it's going to be exciting.
Yes.
It'll definitely be exciting. Colin?
You know, I feel like my capacity to be surprised by things is diminishing with each passing. That really surprised me that he would even say that. And I have just assumed in a real default kind of way that he is not interested in a third term. I was truly, truly shocked. I have no idea what status that particular statement has, but it really surprised me.
Well, I'm sorry we ran out of time before we got a chance to talk about a new Hard Rock Hotel coming to Hartford. Maybe we'll save that for next week on The Wheelhouse. I want to thank Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Thank you, Colin.
Seems like you wouldn't get much sleep in a Hard Rock Hotel.
Leah Reitinger is a professor of public policy at the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. Her most recent book is The Loneliness of the Black Republican, Pragmatic Politics and the Pursuit of Power. Good to see you, Leah.
Always a pleasure to be here.
And also thanks to Kevin Rennie, who's an attorney and he's a columnist for The Hartford Courant. He also writes a great blog called Daily Ructions. Kevin, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you for inviting me.
Our program is produced by Tucker Ives, with help from Kyone Wolf, Heather Brandon, Katie Solarski. I'm John Dankosky, and this is Where We Live.